Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome, everybody, to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, I have a very special guest. His name, Gareth Owen, OBE. Gareth is a former humanitarian director of Save the Children UK. This is a role he held between 2024. Gareth's very respected in the field. He's one of the most influential leaders the humanitarian field has had. Over two decades, he built and led Save the Children's humanitarian department, getting global prominence, and he co-founded initiatives such as the Humanitarian Leadership Academy. Today, Gareth shares his experience as a consultant, a coach, and an author. And I worked with Gareth for 2 or 3 years and can vouch for his energy, for his knowledge. And I'm excited to talk to you today, Gareth. So welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
I am fine, Simon. Thank you for that introduction. That's very kind of you. I'm doing okay. We're going to get into this, I'm sure. The world is in a bit of a state, so let's see what we can make of it.
Yeah. Do you want to start off just by giving a bit of a brief background, a bit deeper than I've given your journey, and then we'll get into the other stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just very quickly. I should probably start with a couple of caveats, since we're going to be talking about the liberal order and the state of the world. I am not a lawyer or a political scientist. I'm actually a civil engineer who fell into humanitarian work more than 3 decades ago. But I'm lucky that I had good teachers on the basics of geopolitics, philosophy, economics along the way, people like yourself. And I guess I was curious enough by nature to always try and reflect on the consequences and the implications of the work I was doing around the world. So I began my humanitarian career as a volunteer in Somalia in the early 90s. Just after the United States had sent 30,000 US Marines to Somalia to end a civil war and bring a famine to a halt. It was known as Operation Restore Hope, and hope is an interesting word for these times today. Most people, if they're old enough, remember what happened in Somalia at that time from the Black Hawk Down movie. It didn't end well for that intervention. In fact, the implications of that elsewhere in the world were very severe for a long time. And after being in Somalia as a volunteer, I was immediately sent into another civil war in Angola, which was one of post-colonial history's most brutal civil wars. I've actually got a book coming out on it on the 28th of March, shameless plug, called Unhealed Wounds, Trauma Aid in Angola, which is about my time there in the siege of Malange in 1994. And people often ask me, why do you write memoirs about stuff that happened decades ago? And what they really mean is, why should anyone care about the psychodramas of a pale, male, stale Western aid worker? And the short answer is, I like to use my own experiences of bygone eras as information, education, and inspiration for the future. I mean, the longer answer to that question is more exposing and painful. The book Unhealed Wounds was the outcome of trauma therapy that I had avoided for a quarter of a century. So I hope the book might serve as invitation to others, as you know, to consider their own needs. But the contemporary relevance, the reason I bring it up, and then we can get on, is I think Angola's history is a cautionary tale for what's going on today about the worst excesses of superpower rivalry, the world we seem to be returning to very quickly now. The war there was fueled by the West's exploitative desire for oil. It was fought with the help of mercenaries. It was sustained by the greed of indigenous elites. Revenues from blood diamonds, medieval siege tactics, starvation were employed. And it was overshadowed at the time by events in Europe, where the Bosnia conflict drew most international attention. And the humanitarian response, which I was involved in, was severely hampered by resource constraints. So the parallels in terms of human suffering with current events in Ukraine, in Gaza, in Sudan, in Venezuela, are now Iran are pretty obvious. We need to learn from history, Simon.
We do, Gareth. I mean, one thing is interesting about you. You've held kind of senior positions in institutions, in sort of bureaucracies, and seen the wheels of politics work. But you've also had a really deep experience of being on the ground in war zones, in very traumatic situations. What does that kind of do to you in terms of the work you do today?
I've been to more than a dozen civil wars over the last three decades. Keeps the passion going, Simon. It fires the passions. I think humanitarianism is not something you inherit in a job title. It's something you come to understand in your bones deeply and often painfully over a long time. So my experiences over the last three decades give me a perspective, I suppose, on the human condition. I think humanitarian work over a long career is really an exploration of human nature in different ways. So you get into the psychology of people, and I think really you learn to cherish, and perhaps we'll come back to this, I can say more later, but you learn to cherish deeply the importance and the power of deep human connection and human encounter, which is something I think people are losing in today's world of increasingly sort of supercognition and AI and all the rest of it. You become very, very close to yourself and to the people who you meet. And it's always about their stories. And it's always about the power of that as an inspirational thing for everything you try and do for the world.
Yeah. And I think that's really important because we in a way, our defense mechanisms have to be in place because, like, we see wars on TV, we see it on the social media, we kind of read about it, and it becomes like a soap opera sort of narrative. And, you know, at the moment, the Eco-Leadership Institute, we have colleagues in Ukraine getting bombed. We have a colleague in Iran, in Tehran, who's getting bombed. We have a colleague in Beirut getting bombed. And, like, you know, these are real lives suffering real traumas and real consequences. And that side of it often gets kind of, pushed aside, and it becomes a bit like a fantasy for a lot of people, I think.
Definitely. I think that there's many challenges in the modern aid system. The way it's evolved over the last quarter of a century, this question of how it relates to how the world works, as it were, the functioning of the liberal order, which is, so I remember a few years ago, someone said to me, "What is this liberal order thing you keep going on about, Gareth?" But in the case, people don't know. I mean, we're talking about the framework of rules-based cooperation, relationships among states that's kept the world relatively peaceful since the end of the Second War, thanks mainly to the economic and military power of the US and its allies. And that's about diplomacy and multilateralism and international institutions as a means to manage conflict and foster cooperation. And it's been institutionalized over decades since the Second War through, obviously, the United Nations initially, the World Bank, IMF, and the World Trade Organization. But it's breaking down. And there's a story to this that I think is it's really clear it's breaking down. But the system that was built and the aid system that was built through it and around it and as part of it have been inextricably linked throughout that time. So what happens is it's become very bureaucratized. You know, the short story is that humanitarianism was seen as a tool of the liberal order, if you like. It was seen as a good PR tool. I didn't realize when I started in the early 90s that my journey as a humanitarian was kind of coinciding with this unique period in international relations. I mean, infamously now called the end of history by Francis Fukuyama. And so, and the idea that, you know, interventionism and Western values, the Cold War was over, the West had won, celebrating democracy, the rule of law, power controlled by legal law, free market economies, all of that, we know the story of that now, but its effect on it meant that aid, an era of big aid was created where a lot more money was put into the aid system. I mean, in military campaigns like Somalia, where I started, were even labeled humanitarian interventions. And lots of money flowed in and lots of procedural elements were introduced. And the reason I say this is it built up this kind of, the aid sector built up this environment of compliance and risk management and accountability that became like, almost became a simulation. And I think this is something you probably encountered when you first started working with us, the idea that this big, thick layer of sediment of bureaucracy sort of overlaying human pain and reality, which is what you're talking about, people on the front line around the world experiencing the traumas and the horrors of war, encountering a system that is supposed to be there to help them, that is really highly bureaucratized and functions in quite a dehumanized way, upwardly, as it were, into the sort of liberal order. It's quite a, I suppose it's quite an elaborate thing I'm saying, but I think you get the idea of what I'm talking about. That interface between human reality and a system that is dominated by kind of managerialism and this kind of technocracies of modernity. People exist in that system a long way from the human pain, a long way from that human encounter that I'm talking about. And it just wasn't like that when I was a young aid worker. Most of that elaborate apparatus. You weren't dealing with that. You didn't deal with that level of technocracy. You dealt with people. You didn't have modern communications where a curious manager 1,000, 10,000 miles away can interrupt your day on the front line somewhere with an email and want something urgent. You didn't have that. You know, you had to rely on people on the front line and then relationships.
I mean, I came to the sector, I'd been dipped into the sector in the past. I'd been to Kosovo, I'd been to Sudan, working the Red Cross and Red Crescent and with the UN. But I came fairly, without a lot of knowledge of the sector. And I was pretty deeply shocked by what I saw. That gap between like going to Zimbabwe, meeting people from Ukraine, people who kind of live in like the front line and what they're encountering, what they're dealing with. And then these levels of bureaucracy and the centralization and the managerialism in the center, which slowed things down and sent the money to the wrong kind of places and made people fill out those forms before they could get money for the wrong kind of aid, which they didn't need. And like, you know, these stories after stories. So it definitely kind of got clogged up at one end. And then at the other end, we have this kind of right-wing political kind of movement, which wants to kind of destabilize the whole system. What's your thoughts on how those two things have kind of played out and I mean, there's two different stories, isn't there? One is the kind of the aid system got sucked into something it shouldn't have been and got kind of stifled a bit. And then there's this polemic other kind of side, which wants to get rid of any kind of liberal order altogether.
Well, let's start with the latter of those. I mean, the recent arc of history to all this, I think, is quite important to consider. It's why when I said I didn't really realize I was coexisting with it as I began as a volunteer all those years ago. My favorite TV show, Simon, is The West Wing. Which is quite dated now. I even have a Bartlett for President t-shirt that I wear sometimes in bed. But there's a scene early on where in the first series, which aired in 1999, you mentioned Kosovo. I was in Kosovo in 1999 when this series was first aired. And the scene is the president has lost his personal physician, who's been killed in a missile strike on a US military transporter. And the president is threatening to take it personally. And he threatens to rain down fire with the fury of God's own thunder, only for his chief of staff, Leo McGarry, to intervene and tell him, well, you can do that. You have the power. You are the world's superpower, but I'll raise up an army against you. And Leo was making the point that the world's only superpower had a responsibility to show the most restraint. And he talked about it being proportionate and reasonable and responsible and merciful. And he finally convinces the president of his point by saying to him, it's what our fathers taught us. And the president says, well, why didn't you just say so? So that was the view in 99 about the US might as the world's policeman. That view still held sway. I think there's another sort of historical reference that I sometimes comes to mind, which is from Alan Bennett's play, The History Boys, when he says there's nothing so distant as the recent past. The point being putting recent events into their historical context. They're too new for that to be accurately placed. Yeah. But if you look through the 21st century and the evolution of this arc that's brought us to where we are today, it's become much clearer. In Kosovo, when I was there, I remember hearing a story where allegedly Tony Blair was turned to Madeleine Albright, who was the US Secretary of State at the time, and as the military intervention was getting underway, and said, my lawyers say this military operation is illegal, to which Albright is allegedly to have replied, get some more lawyers. And that's an example of the sort of exceptionalism that's always been present in when powerful Western nations employ, you know, they always employ that exceptionalism to their sort of interventions.
Yeah.
The point being that international law functions as a consensus without real teeth, and it's only as ever good as how it's collectively enacted and collectively agreed. So it's gone from being something that nations attempted to still respect back then to being a charade, to being used as a cynical excuse, and finally now being ignored altogether. If you think about the Iraq war in 2003, you can remember how the elaborate ends the US and UK went to justify regime change by talking about weapons of mass destruction, UN resolutions. It was an attempt to sort of legitimize it all. But that's gone now. So what we see as a result of that is the sort of might is right mindset of you know, superpower rivalry. And that's this destructive side. It's much easier to do what you want if there are no rules. And it's sort of what they called now if the rules are completely ignored, where does that leave us? It's this kind of normalization of deviance, you know, the idea that you just gradually become desensitized. So that's one aspect of it, which I think is incredibly important. And it leaves humanitarians and people are trying to mitigate the worst effects of this, just wondering what they're facing next if the gloves are truly off. And has the world forgotten why we created this system? And this period of relative peace over the last 80 years that's been described as a holiday from history is over. And it, so the result, and the reason I go through that sort of arc very quickly there, is if we are in this kind of post-industrial era for aid and it, for humanitarians, you know, seeing everything, you know, the money drying up, the staff being laid off while the world's on fire, then the human result is these widespread feelings of anger and grief and weariness and weather-beatenness amongst the people you encountered, Simon. And the double bind of the world being in this place and then a bureaucratized system. So they've got this internal challenge and they've got this external challenge, and those two things are colliding in individuals, and it creates what I think you called in your seminal work on eco-mutualism and the need for it in humanitarianism, the disenchantment, and what I call the, and others call the loss of the humanitarian soul.
Yeah, and it seems to me like big picture, like there's all the rules and the laws, you know, all the contractual stuff, but actually what held it together was a covenant. It was like a general covenant of like fairness, of trying to hold things together. We knew that some countries were more powerful than others. We knew there was a lot of diverse kind of opinions, but there was some sort of general kind of agreement that authoritarianism was not a good thing, that kind of authoritarianism was not a good thing, that we tried to live with our neighbors for economic reasons, for humanitarian reasons. And that's been blown out of the water, hasn't it?
Entirely. I mean, we watched this picture build up. You know, wind the clock forward 20 years from when I was mentioning, you know, Iraq, and you get to the invasion of Ukraine, where Vladimir Putin cited Article 51 of the UN Charter as his reason for the invasion, which is that article is about the right to self-defense and the enforcement of peace. So he was claiming humanitarianism as part of his act. And then you have Gaza, where the military offensive has created conditions that make life unbearable for 2 million people. Bombings that kill civilians in huge numbers, destroys infrastructure, and collectively punishes through those tactics of starvation and siege, which are completely illegal under international law, to the point where these actions are considered genocidal. You see the consequences of this deviance from the kind of rules-based setup. And so Gaza really served as a revelation. It pulled back the curtain on the idea that this global consensus, you know, that sits behind this kind of rules-based order, that required restraint on the part of the most powerful, to all intents and purposes, has been ripped up by the same people who created it. And then now to the point where there's not even a consideration, it seems, of the legal realities before powerful countries attack others.
Yeah. I mean, there used to be kind of veiled excuses. Now they don't even bother with the veiled excuses.
That's
it's
right.
Just like, no, we have the power. In this world we live in now, in the present circumstances, tell us what you think humanitarian needs and where it goes from here.
Well, I mean, we're in this interregnum where the old world that humanitarians knew, and many people, you know, the key, we can't be nostalgic for a past that isn't going to return. But there's a predictive melancholia attached to all this. People are seeing this kind of dystopian future that they feared, and it's kind of already arriving. And this kind of idea that, you know, back to this point about disenchantment and the loss of the soul, it's worth digging into that a little bit, because I think it's what we're talking about, the human factor, it kind of exists as a tension. It's living in the space between these things. On the one side, the instinctive human pull to compassion that allows you to feel another's pain and try and do something about it and be supported. And on the other hand, this machinery of modern institutions, the risk registers, the compliance regimes, the performance dashboards, the machinery, and I use machine language advisedly, you know, the mechanistic, the sort of soul has always occupied the space between these things and is trying to remain intact now in systems of institutional order that are increasingly do feel like they are very far removed from the human truth of what they're trying to represent. The soul isn't something you inherit from a job title. But I've always felt this, the bureaucracy of titles and structure and hierarchy, it's always had its own kind of slow violence that's capable of subduing even the most open-hearted and determined humanitarians. And so if it can't be felt on encounter, and Simon, you know, we talked about this many times, in organizations that claim to honor this kind of soulful part, then it really is severely diminished. It's not a monotheistic or metaphysical point about soul. It's about human relational depth rather than divinity. It's about the wounds, the longings, the convictions that accumulate through willing proximity and deep connection to the pain of others. It's a way of speaking about all that without invoking supernatural ontology. It definitely has the soul, and the loss of it inevitably has something to do with the way the formal structure and its institutions, which are products of the zeitgeist, as we're describing, they are products of the world they seek to civilize, it was famously said by Barnett. And the incentives and cultures and behaviors that are dominating the world inevitably also feature inside the formal aid system. And one of the things that's caused, one of the problems that's caused by this, to come to the answer to your question about what needs to happen, is humanitarian institutions, and I'm talking about the formal sector really, which is the UN, the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, the big NGOs where I work, the big aid, as it were. They're generally too busy now trying to survive as institutions.
Yeah.
And still trying to deliver, you know, help to millions of people around the world who need it. That crowds out space for critical reflection, the kind of thing that, you know, we're trying to, you know, encourage between us here and in writing and everything else. And this creeping managerialism and this tyranny of being busy, it's just driven out the space for contemplation, which keeps the humanitarian soul functioning as an organization's moral compass. So if you haven't got that, then what are the red lines that you won't allow to be crossed? What is the stance of solidarity that you will hold no matter what the potential costs are? How are you enacting your relationship with others in a mutual sense, in an equal sense, without the, you know, without power dynamics overriding? So this is all inextricably linked to the kind of criticisms of legitimacy that are being leveled against the West in general and its hypocrisies and the formal system that is very much part of it. Essentially, it's draining energy and drive just when it's needed most, when we need the maximum imagination and the maximum creativity. Professor Stephen Hopgood from the SOAS in 2019, he said the humanitarian alliance with liberalism is no accident. And if the world is less liberal, its version of humanitarian action is likely to be less liberal too. So that's deeply painful for practicing humanitarians to contend with. That is a moral wound that festers deep. And it's this dysfunction for individuals and groups that results that becomes very profound. So we've got to address that by, firstly, I think, facing up to it and saying, this is our reality now. There's no point trying to hold on to the past. Forget. Don't think this is a genuine ending. We are on a liminal boundary. We're in an interregnum between an old world we knew with all its criticisms and a new world that we just don't know where it's going to come from. And essentially the backdrop I'm describing here is a loss of hope. And there's a famous quote in the aid world from the Red Cross, which is, it's not the bombs and bullets that are our greatest enemy, it's our own despair. At this point, if Kate was listening to Simon, my partner, who you know well, she would say, my God, Gareth, this is far too bleak. Can you put some hope into this story before everybody loses heart entirely? And it is a hopeful side to this if we approach this differently, if we allow the imagination and the inspiration we get from others. You've always said this, you know, you're completely inspired by the people you've met around the world, so am I. And it comes down to the choices we all decide to make. What is the contribution we're all going to make? It's in the actions we choose to take in the face of this kind of extreme adversity. Do you stand up and be counted? Are you silent? Do you look away? What are you going to do as an individual? That's really the question everyone's facing now.
And in this interregnum, there's always opportunities. There's always there's when something breaks down, there's always opportunities. And, you know, we're in the West, we're stuck in the West, we're stuck in Western mindsets and modern mindsets. And this is one of the problems that I think people can't think outside of those mindsets, ways of thinking. If I just came back from China last year and we did some experiential learning group outside Beijing, and it was a very different kind of feeling there, a very different kind of experience. And in Asia widely, there's different energies in different parts of the world. There's kind of a resistance to the old order as well. There's lots of talk about decolonization, that there's potential kind of areas of growth. How do you see that playing out? Like, the old order is dying in many ways. Some of it needs to die. Some of it is brutal and very worrying. How do you see kind of a reemergence of the humanitarian sector, the field, the space?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. Always historically, I mean, the dominant system, the convenient, conventional system was never the full story ever. I mean, there's enormous remittance income that dwarfs organized aid by many, many multiples orders of magnitude.
Let me just share that with the audience. So by remittance, this is money being sent back by people working back to relatives and to friends. Is that, that's what you mean?
That's right. Yeah, diasporas around the world who send money home to help support their family. I mean, almost everybody who's part of a diaspora does this the world over, and enormous amounts of money flow that way, much more than the organized aid money. So there's always been this other space away from the international relations order, the rules-based order. But the challenge is scaling all those efforts and a recognition of how do you support through solidarity and mutualism being we're all equal, but in a very purposeful sense. How do you support that? You have to break down. Most of the money historically has come from powerful, rich nations, the same ones that built the rules-based order, the same ones that are destroying it now. So there's a lot of people who are trying to sort of refinance their business model, really, in this time in the organized sector. And they'll do that. I mean, that's up to them. I left it because I was much more interested in what you're talking about now, which is what's out there. What's out there beyond the walls of this kind of organized, kind of simulated bureaucracy that we built. And there's enormous amounts.
Yeah.
So I think what ends up happening, the problem is after order comes disorder. And can be chaotic, that period of disorder, and we're probably in it. So we're going to have to come through this before. And some people would legitimately say, well, that's the tumult of the Second World War, and the history teaches us we had to build. That's why we created the UN. Is it just that 80 years on, we've forgotten why we did it? We'd have to rebuild that. And we will need to rebuild, apparatus of international order. We can't solve planetary problems, like climate change, without cooperation. But I think what's probably going to happen is some form of zonal geopolitics will emerge. It's kind of already there. If we are entering a kind of an old world of kind of inter-imperial conflict, then it's going to be, and if it's spheres of influence based, the old Monroe Doctrine type language that's been circulating recently, then the zones where this plays out, there will have to be resistance. There will have to be, organized opposition to the worst effects of that. And that's going to be a much more complicated mosaic than people have known recently. And I think, but I think also the interesting point, and this comes up a lot when I talk to students, is, here in the UK, where obviously most of my understanding and insight is derived from having worked in headquarters in London for a big NGO, you're going to have to rediscover your politics.
Yeah.
And this is the big story. There was I think you were there, Simon. Do you remember the launch of the Alameda Institute, which is this think tank that we had in London?
I was there, in London.
A couple of years ago. Do you remember William Shockey's words? Fantastic. Yeah. The young South African writer who came to and said, look, basically said, if you want to help us in the sort of peripheral edges of the known world, as it were, or however you want to describe it, that's the West, how the West sort of feels about those. He said, sort out your terrible politics at home. I mean, how right was he? I mean, it couldn't be more prescient what he was saying two years on. So I think, and I say this to students who are interested in humanitarianism when I talk to them, you're going to have to discover your relationship with your own discomfort, and you're going to have to really dig in there inwardly and figure out how you are with that, because it's going to be a fight. Facing up to all this is going to require, you can't expect others to do it. You're going to have to organize. You're going to have to build big alliances. It's going to be hard work. It's going to be contested. And you're going to have to summon that if you're going to contend with the world that is, there's no rosy picture here.
I hear what you're saying. It aligns very much. I mean, the work I'm doing at the moment in the EQS Institute is we're doing quite a lot on what we call soul and work. And for me, these things get split off. People are like, they go off and do mindfulness to kind of relax or to kind of shut the world out, or they go and do some spirituality stuff, But for me, it's like the humanitarian soul or the soul at work. Like, you have to get in touch with some kind of deep value, some deep ethos first. Once you get in touch with that, then you have to face up to the dirty stuff. It's the politics, it's the friction, it's the tensions, it's the organizing, the hard work, the grafting. But the two things have to come together. If you just have one, it becomes instrumental and you become kind of self-defeating, So for me, it's about kind of binding these two things together.
Absolutely. And I think it starts with self. I think Kate and I, who I mentioned, my partner, we've been doing a really interesting project on human-centeredness over the last few months. So basically, it's like a sense-making project. We're talking to a diverse group of senior, accomplished people from all walks of life, from military, from the clergy, different religions, from politics. And we're asking them, it's the kind of question you always ask them, what is your definition of kind of human-centered behavior? And it's been really, really fascinating and inspirational. And what we're seeing really is what you're saying. It's this, people always bring it back to, well, who am I? What is my value base? What is my, at the center, at my core, what are my beliefs? And then what is the philosophy that I hold around my beliefs? And then what purpose do I give all that? And what is the contribution I want to make for the world? And then how am I going to practice? And how is that all going to be aligned? I think that's what you're saying. This alignment of you know, because then you're grounded, and to use the sort of parlance that's very common today, when you've got all that aligned, you're very embodied in terms of how you engage with the world. And whilst all its troubles and tribulations and problems will come at you, you asked me this at the start, you know, what have I learned? This is what I've learned. If you're going to engage with the world's difficulties for a living, all of that alignment has to be work to get that aligned, and the awareness that you have to have. The more you can do that, the more you're able to engage, the more you can be in proximity, and the more you're able to sustain your struggle, the more energy you have, the more passion you have, the more fight you have in you, and the more you are open and curious, and the valency you have for, you know, the relationship with others, the more authentic they are. Because I think one of the things that I think is another part of this story, and I think it's why it's so important, the work you do and the podcast, is where are the spaces for people to really talk about this and have the ongoing deep conversation about this without fear of consequence? You can't have it inside institutions, because everybody is there terrified that they'll trip over their words, say the wrong thing, offend somebody, and before you know it, the institutional machinery is on you. I don't think institutions can conjure the necessary spaces to have what they call psychologically safe conversations. What I'm just talking about is truthful conversations where you leave all your everything at the door and you come in and you meet each other as human beings and you have a well-curated, wise conversation about the stimulus you're all experiencing, and it takes you forward. I mean, I've experienced that going on your program, Simon. I was a bit lucky to go on your coaching course, and the depth work and the relational work, it's really, really powerful. But it takes expertise like yours. It takes time. You can't do it in a rush. And, you know, what you see with leaders is, let's have a really meaningful conversation for a day. We'll come together with all the heads of UN agencies, whatever. They'll have the right conversation for a day, and then they'll disappear for another 120 days, get incredibly busy again, right back to the same problems, and then might come up another day. So the conversation isn't broad enough, it isn't deep enough, it isn't being sustained enough, and it isn't truthful enough to actually get people, to give people the energy and the, you know, I think the confidence and the courage, you know, to sort of say, right, let's stand up to this properly together.
Yeah, and for me, there's also a piece of this. People need to reckon with where they are, and there's a distinct lack in the humanitarian field and in other organizations I work in, other sectors, around like critical thinking, being able to really dialogue and kind of do some of the deeper work, and to think outside of the modernity mindset, which is all about linearity, about reduction in science. You know, everyone's turning into neuroscience now. But what about kind of like ecosystems? What about kind of our connections to the other? What about, you know, we haven't mentioned the environment, we're in serious, serious trouble. It's going to have a major, major impact on resources, on people, on migration, on, you know, all these issues are going to be hitting us, you know. And we need to have kind of dialogues around that, and thoughtful dialogues, you know, and not retreat into kind of memes and kind of like sound bites, you know, but doing that deeper thinking, which is, you have to invest time, you have to invest kind of energy into that.
Well, that's exactly it. It does take time. It does take energy. And it starts with curiosity. One of my criticisms that I observed inside the aid system is that people are so locked into that paradigm, they can't see beyond it. They don't get to the window and look out, let alone get the other side of the glass into that ecosystem, into the places that you've been, where this huge diversity that exists in society, well beyond this formal Western-dominated system that is so critiqued now. I don't think anyone thinks that can be sustained. And I think the stakes are so high now, because it's what Einstein said, the fourth world war will be fought with rocks. We are in a 2-degree warmer world, if whether we like it or not. It's a more unstable and more dangerous inter-imperial arrangement that's emerging, with significant implications for international governance and cooperation, the very things that are going to help. So we're seeing a retreat from cooperation and global alliance, and that is the road to disaster. So we've got to stop. We've got to say, stop, everybody. Stop the simulation, stop, you know, performative behavior and systems that seem emptied out, that no longer serve the purpose they were created for. And we've got to create new alliances on a grand scale that will compel great powers to moderate their pursuit of greed and interest, you know.
And in my experience, I think one of the things people miss out on is when you belong to a local community, a global community, when you feel a sense of working with others in collaborative form, you know, there's a real life joy in this. There's like, you know, there's a joyousness in working through tensions and coming out the other end. There's a joyousness in kind of helping mutually the other and them helping you, allowing this to happen. There's actually, it's a life force in that. And it's like, people kind of see it as something kind of to do because it's doing good. No, it's because it's actually kind of there's a life force in it. That's how the world works, and that's how the world works well, with all its tensions, with all its foils, with all its kind of power games, you know. But within that, like there's that's where the joy lies. That's where life is, you know, in collaboration, in being with the other.
Absolutely. And you know, the reality, face reality, everybody, anyone who cares about humanity has to start learning that what you're describing is the only answer. The next decade is going to be very, very hard. The world may well be entering a dark period that is going to test us all. So you either suffer in silence, you either try and do all the personal mitigations that don't really solve anything, or you come together and you stand up. And it's not the first time. One of the things about history that shows you is the world's faced periods of disunity and fragmentation before, and it's found a way forward to new avenues of solidarity that have been ultimately beneficial. The United Nations is an example of that. It's just not functioning in an egalitarian way that the world wants it to. Its institutions are stuck. So the best question I was ever asked about this, when it boils down to it, someone said to me once, what are you willing to be really unpopular for? It's such a clarifying question, because it demands you to say, what do I really care about? And what am I really going to stand up for? And what am I going to be stubbornly hopeful about in these circumstances? And it's got to be your relationships with others. It's got to be real relationships, not the simulated versions in cyberspace. And if we're going to rejuvenate humanitarianism as a movement, if you like, that is going to help do what it was always supposed to do, which is mitigate the worst effects of a highly unfair world dominated by small groups of powerful nations, then it is only a broad social movement based on global solidarity that will do that. So start with who you are, start local. Are you connected to people around you? Or do you, like I do in London, live in a multi-share building where I hardly know anybody? It's crazy, but that's so many people live like that. And it's a big job, this, and it's not going to be done, led by institutions anytime soon. They're too busy surviving. So no, it's going to be about this, what you do as an individual with this.
Yeah, this is a shift towards sort of solidarity and ecosystems, because, you know, like, when I worked in the health sector, like you got overwhelmed by the size of the NHS, you know, you couldn't change anything. You felt like you're a cog in the wheel of the machine. But you start thinking about ecosystems and small connections leading to kind of larger connections, leading to kind of bigger change. Now, sometimes we can feel impotent, but actually these small changes make a difference. And it's really about making those connections and finding your own soul, your own values, and starting in partnerships and actually discovering the joys of living with humans and non-humans, with nature alongside us. And that's kind of, I think, the beginning of the journey.
I couldn't agree more, Simon. I was inspired by your work and eco-leadership and by attending, you know, the course. You have to actively build your network. And I've discovered the joy of it, the absolute joy. For Kate and I, this project with Sensemating, we start talking to people who, you know, we knew, and we ask them to introduce us to other people we don't know. Do you know anybody in this sphere? Do you know anyone in that sphere? And before you know it, you're building a network. And what's amazing is people do want that relational capital. They do want to talk to you. And then they're curious about what you're discovering. And then they ask, hey, can we come together? And there are infinitely more good people out there. There are way more creative people. You know, it's just that they don't get the space. And we convince ourselves that it's all doom and gloom. It really isn't. You can't be that way in today's world. Yes, we face reality. Then we have to fight. And the freedom for us in this is in how we come together.
That's right. And I think that's a great place to leave it, Gareth. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts.
My pleasure, Simon, as always.
Yeah, you take care.
See you soon, Simon. Take care.
Bye now.